Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Hello, this is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Medicine. I recently spoke with Rebecca Lemoff, Associate Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University, about her new book, Database of Dreams, The Lost Quest to Catalog Humanity, published by Yale University Press in 2015. Database of Dreams offers a beautifully written glimpse into the data practices of psychology and anthropology from the 1920s through the 1960s. She traces the history of projected tests, like the Rorschach and TAT, alongside dream analysis and life history, as these methods came to be applied in settings of cross-cultural research. It is also the history of a fascinating yet forgotten analog database technology, the microcard, through the life and work of Bert Kaplan, who trained at Harvard's Department of Social Relations and devoted his life to the collection of myriad kinds of human data, a catalog of human personality, in a sense. Lemoff's book gives us necessary pause to scrutinize the present obsession with passively collecting more and more data about human subjects, often qua consumers. I speak here of the practices commonly understood as big data. In our discussion, we touched on this, along with other fascinating threads taken up by the book. I can strongly recommend this book for anyone interested in the history of psychology or anthropology, and also to readers more concerned with contemporary debates on whether and how human selves are being reconfigured in new ways through regimes of data collection. I hope you enjoyed this interview. Rebecca, welcome to New Books in Medicine.
Thanks, Mikey. It's nice to be here.
So, as we've kind of discussed, the way we like to start our broadcast is by discussing kind of how you came into the subject itself, the field, and sort of what inspires this current book.
Mm-hmm. This is a very good question because I actually have been trying to reconstruct when I first heard about this peculiar collection of dreams and other subjective materials, which I came to write the book about, and I came to call the Database of Dreams, but I can't quite remember the first time I heard about it. It's as if I always knew about it. And I think that's because it goes back to my my dissertation research, in which I became captivated by this kind of legendary filing cabinet at Yale, and that had been started in the 1930s and kind of reached its heyday right after World War II, in which they attempted to file all human cultural materials or information about every possible human activity, belief, even things like flora, fauna, culture, broken down into 553 major categories and a number of subcategories. And so in doing research on these Yale files, which were called Yale's Bank of Knowledge sometimes, or sometimes just the files, which attempted to be complete, I started to, I guess, run across footnotes that mentioned another filing system that dealt with dreams and seemed even more elusive or sort of more intriguing to me. And so, and also, it had never really taken off. So, so that's how I kind of got interested in it. And I ended up, I guess those footnotes must've made an impression, because then I circled back later on.
Mm-hmm. And you have a background in anthropology, so this project is kind of bringing your empirical work kind of closer to your own training in a way.
Yeah, it also feels like circling around in that sense, I guess, to my training in anthropology. And also, I've always been interested in, even in my dissertation, in the not simply anthropology, but its allegiances with sociology and psychology and even like other fields. And it's kind of this capacious vision of anthropology. So in many of the high points of, you know, American anthropology, it actually envisioned itself as just one aspect of behavioral science. Mm. And I seem to keep being drawn back to that interdisciplinary vision or cross-disciplinary vision of anthropology. So this particular project that I end up writing the book about is a great example, because there was almost no distinction between psychological, sociological, or anthropological information. But I can get more specific about how that's the case.
Yeah, well, I kind of wanted to start it by talking about the dreams part of the title and the sort of the function that dreams as data serve for you, because there's this interesting problem framed in a few ways in the book about the ethical nature, the legality of certain kinds of data, and also what different kinds of data mean for emerging disciplines. So you deal in what could be characterized as psychology, amongst other things, with projective tests, like TATs and Rorschach plots, but dreams are kind of a very different sort of data even in that sphere, right? You have projective tests are obviously very open-ended, but they become standardized in a certain way. So dreams kind of open on to different territory for estimating meanings of human lives. And then the other interesting thing is that as anthropological data, you kind of frame the problematic of anthropologists essentially trying to extract the secrets and functional aspects of cultures, and how this sort of secret extraction, while also related to espionage in a really interesting and problematic way, dreams have kind of this more neutral content to them, and that allows them to kind of function and be exchanged in a more ready way. So I guess, yeah, I wanted to talk about dreams as a lens into this sort of research.
Yeah, I was drawn to dreams, and I think they symbolize this, you know, on two levels, both the dream of a certain kind of data I found a set of historical actors who were very interested in pushing the limits of the kinds of data you could collect. So not just data about, you know, family budgets but could you actually collect the people's nighttime dreams and make them survive in some kind of format. So it was a technological challenge, but it was also a kind of aspiration. So the dream stands as kind of the limit of a certain kind of data.
Yeah.
But you mentioned projective tests. One thing that's interesting is some sociologists and psychologists and anthropologists who use the projective test thought of it as a way of producing a controlled dream. So there's actually a lot of fluidity between, you would have different techniques that might produce usable data, but they seem to, in the minds of the social scientists, have something in common. They all had a dreamlike quality, or that's the kind of evidence they were interested in. And it was almost a kind of interest in, somehow capturing the procedural contents of someone's experience, not just their state of mind, but really what it was like to be another person as they sort of experience, like a stream of consciousness. like a GoPro, projected backwards into the 1950s. I think that was the ultimate goal. And a dream is appealing because it actually, in some sense, it does have a coherent shape and someone can recite it to you. And,
And there were certain, I guess, intellectual centers that fostered or pushed dream analysis as like a viable methodology. So departing from kind of, you know, the standard understanding of, like, you know, Freudian dream analysis, I think that you cite two UChicago anthropologists who were very big at pushing this agenda. So this kind of, against even the sort of Dust Bowl empiricists that are described as also conducting some of these surveys. Right. So is there a particular theoretical lineage of this, or?
Well, I often think of it, like, the main dream collector in this project was Dorothy Eggen, who is now quite forgotten. I think it's safe to say her husband was the head of the anthropology department, Fred Eggen, at Chicago. And there were actually a lot of the key players in this project had something to do with Chicago, and also something to do with the Midwest. And then there were also links with Harvard. But the Chicago part, I think the tradition of psychoanalysis there did influence Dorothy Eggen and Fred Eggen, but and Dorothy Eggen underwent intensive psychoanalysis throughout her adult life. And I think she attributed to that, to her several analysts, like the insights that she gained in trying to apply dream gathering techniques to what she would call primitives or Hopi Indians. But she also is in many ways post-Freudian, and her radical idea was that you didn't have to look for deep meaning in dreams, that often the meaning was quite near the surface, particularly with what she called primitive dreams of the Hopi Indians. So she actually, in some ways, one of her pioneering articles was called Manifest Content in Dream Collection, I think. She was actually very well known for these articles in her day, and she's an interesting figure I can talk more about. But anyway, I think in her orientation was both, she was influenced by Freudian theories, but she was also a kind of a renegade in the sense that she said there was no, you could easily find the meaning of the dream by embedding it in the cultural surroundings of the person. You didn't have to look for some kind of deep or tricky or, you know, some kind of Freudian meaning.
Right. There's no kind of, you know, signifier that one is seeking out in the dream. It's more about the kind of act of recollection and what that reveals about cultural experience seems to be the difference.
And also having dreams in large amounts was important. So it's not so much, you know, Freud is notable for what he can do with one small dream. He, you know, can spin these amazing webs of interpretation just from Irma's injection. It was kind of a nondescript dream, but Eggen was interested in large amounts of dreams that you could plot in charts, and you could embed in a cultural analysis. You could also use for comparison. And so she gathered more dreams probably than any single anthropologist from, although she wasn't formally trained as an anthropologist, she was a pioneer.
And this whole idea of plotting and sort of showing relations between vast amounts of data is something I think we should talk about later, because I think that emerges as one of the problems of the kind of push to make micro data and make that the kind of fungible form of and legible form of kind of exchange and taking these things down. But I also wanted to push on a little one of the other kind of psychological techniques you talk about earlier in the book that I brought up, projective testing. And what I found really interesting in your, I think it was the third chapter on when you talk about kind of cross-cultural projective testing and the many, many different kinds of resistance and cultural meanings that those are bound up in. And so I think that there is kind of a, you know, dominant sort of pop cultural association with the Rorschach tests and things like that. But I mean, I was wondering if you could sort of explode what maybe a few of those problems are that are encountered in the kind of generalization of projective testing.
Well, yeah, I think it's quite interesting. In that chapter you're referring to, I look at this movement to take the dominant projective tests. Projective tests underwent huge popularity in the middle of the 20th century because they were seen as these, the best the best available techniques for x-raying is seen,
they're X-ray
seen
as like soul,
x-rays
yeah.
of the soul or x-rays of the self or somehow a way of accessing hidden dimensions of subjective experience. And it was also, they were also valorized, particularly the Rorschach, but also the thematic apperception test. And in addition, there was a welter of 40 or 50 other tests that were quite popular, ranging from like the pain apperception test, which asked people to look at pictures of people falling off ladders, and you had to describe what was happening, to, you know, tests that were targeting children, tests that were targeting adults, tests that targeted, you know, different geographical areas. So this was kind of the heyday of the projective test as a special instrument. And to it was attributed both, it was actually described by Marguerite Hertz, I believe, as objectifying the subjective. So it was actually a tool that could take the subjective and render it in objective terms if you were careful enough and you were also kind of modest about. There was both a grandiosity and a modesty to the goals of the projective tests. But in the original forms, people like Rorschach and Henry Murray and Christiana Morgan, who invented these top two tests, didn't envision it necessarily going around the world, although Rorschach actually was interested in testing Swiss people from different cantons. So he was interested in testing the Swiss who lived in the high mountains versus the Swiss who lived in the lowlands, and they had these kind of stereotypical reputations that the mountain dwellers were, you know, brusque and not very talkative, and the lowlanders were friendly. So he wanted to see if the tests would bear out those kind of cultural stereotypes, and he found that they did, and he thought it could be used racially to type people as well. But in the 1930s and 40s, a new generation of quite serious and even indeed legendary anthropologists set out to actually take these, you know, pack up the tests in their kit bags and take them upriver into the most remote areas of the world and try testing groups of people who had, in many cases, never met a white person or never encountered a two-dimensional image, much less a Rorschach test or a, you know, psychological instrument, or even the idea of the psyche,
right,
you could say. So transpired this rather odd undertaking that ultimately was a global project of taking the test to the Saharan Desert and to the South Pacific Islands and to the very, very remote or tribal groups, and sort of asking them to sit down wherever they were and undertake an inkblot test, and then trying to gather these in massive amounts. And what's interesting, so this did reveal, it sort of dramatizes for me, and I found this one of the most engaging parts of doing the research, was that it highlights methodological conundra that would later come to haunt the Rorschach, because it's, you know, it's no longer seen as powerful as it once was, but it shows like the limitations of of many of the claims of the test, and also of the idea of the standardized setting, because the Rorschach was always meant to be given in a special closed room with a professional test giver who was, and the test giver and the subject would be assumed to share the same language. But when people like Irving Hallowell took the Rorschach test to give to the Ojibwe upriver, he would end up giving, you know, administering the test in a range of very odd situations, such as on the beach, or while one of the subjects was doing the dishes, or while the entire family was gathered around, because people didn't necessarily like to be alone with an anthropologist if he was trying to talk to a woman. Actually, it was quite suspect.
Right.
Children were also not comfortable taking the test, so he often had to devise games, or he developed a technique with a orange wood stick where he would have them point at different parts of the... He had to actually improvise to even make the test viable. And so, to his credit, or it's quite interesting because he writes at length about the accommodations he had to make to what you might call the standardized setting. But to him, these accommodations, you know, he had to use an interpreter. To him, it didn't invalidate the test. It just was something you had to be forthright about. So I think that issue is quite interesting. It's kind of about the way technologies move and the way standardization operates, you can see that, you know, different affordances were built in as the test migrated. And so it became kind of surprisingly the story about technology that I hadn't completely expected.
Mm-hmm. And then sometimes even, I believe in Native American tribes, they sort of perceive these packed up sets of cards and things like that as this sort of symbol of kind of government control, and here come the white men again with their, not like their census pads, but you sort of know what I mean, because there was a big issue with like harboring German spies, I think, in one of the sites.
Right.
So you brought up this, there's all these interesting political entanglements that are wrapped up in this history. And,
yeah.
And actually, what I wanted to go to next was, you know, also to kind of pursue further this situation of information gathering and the kind of the, the ethical. So, one of the things I found most interesting was, and I believe this was about taking life histories, but it may not have been, it may have been one of the other methods, but this idea of, the idea of exchange and what makes, what makes something, equitable or even like beneficent. Right. So in establishing the grounds for doing this kind of analysis. So at first it was these kind of ad hoc continual payments to even talk about any of these subjects or to bring up dreams or to bring up cultural secrets. But then it's sort of once the anthropologists become entrenched in these communities, it sort of becomes this revolving door phenomenon where they go to a bar and if somebody needs to get another drink. Right. They need to, they basically just go to the resident anthropologist there and subject themselves to a test. So
that did happen.
Yeah.
Right. It was actually, you could look at it one way as a kind of testament to the creativity and improvisational abilities of the different anthropologists, one of whom did, he had trouble getting people to submit to the Rorschach test or to other tests. And so, especially in one particular community. So he set himself up at a local bar and he would buy a drink in payment for taking the test. So that could be seen as, and there were other cases too, in other communities where, like, these George and Louise Spindler would give rides to people who were trying to hitchhike to the bar, and along the way they would ask them questions or about their life histories, and because or ask to meet other of their relatives. So in some ways they were inserting themselves in the local dynamics, as anthropologists always do. And there's I got interested in just, I think that relationship and trying to move the relationship to the heart of this kind of encounter, to the heart of what anthropology is. And it's always the part that's either put in a footnote or in some kind of appendix. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's not always mentioned how much someone was paid or were they paid more, how much were they paid per dream, or what did they think about that? And for example, the most generous collector or donator of his dreams was a Hopi man named Don Taliesfa, who was paid per dream. He would fill out notebook upon notebook and send them to Chicago, where Dorothy Eggen would then have them typed out by a typist. But he would use the money. He became quite relatively wealthy in Hopi terms to buy. He had had five of his children die, and he ultimately, and this was heartbreaking, of course, for his wife and himself, and ultimately he and his wife adopted a son, and they would use the money to buy Sears Roebuck, like, cowboy outfits for their son to wear and have American-style birthday parties for him, even while his collaboration or connection with the anthropologist made him persona non grata among the Hopi. And he was accused of all the betrayals of generations of Hopi working with anthropologists. He became sort of the symbol of all of that and was despised. Mm-hmm. I think he's a controversial figure even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I thought the book could focus on that situation and bring out the range of, it's almost like a play. You could see, you could look at the records and the archives and a lot of the data, which is as a kind of record of this encounter, and you could read between the lines or against the grain and find all sorts of interesting things. For example, when some Zuni, there were Harvard anthropologists who were interviewing Zuni veterans, and they would be asking them to fill out sentence completion tests. And some of them would, instead of answering the question, for one of the, which was, when I see a white woman, I think blank.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, after a time, you know, one of them said, why, how does this help the Hopi? You know, how does this help the Zunis? I mean, they would insert a kind of powerful commentary on the instrument itself and sort of step outside of the context in which they were embedded. This fascinated me, and it happened many times.
Right, because it's this moment of misunderstanding about what is, you know, professed objectivity and neutrality, right? So the idea is obviously you're gaining something material from doing this research, right? When the anthropologists are trying to assert that they are this kind of neutral middleman between, you know, experience of, you know, indigenous peoples and then, you know, this emergent like human science, right? Mm-hmm. So and that misunderstanding was, I think, yeah, one of the most profound things. Because you wonder at times, I mean, these projects are, the kind of goals of them are not really, you know, well stated. They don't seem to be for any particular practical end. And that's sort of one of the things you discuss with this drive to catalog more mm-hmm. and more, and just the idea of mapping. So, and maybe that's a good point of departure even into kind of the main project that you discuss, the work of Fred Kaplan, who is trained at Harvard. And so his...
Bert Kaplan.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. Bert Kaplan, who was trained at Harvard. And so his quest essentially was to record dreams and other bits of cultural information on these microcards that mm-hmm. are sort of this much forgotten medium. Mm-hmm. And sort of this whole project was very much technological, but it was also the idea of it was to make available and keep useful all of the data from these other kinds of studies. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could just give us an overview of his work.
Sure. Yeah. So Bert Kaplan was trained as a psychologist at Department of Social Relations at Harvard, and he was a student of Clyde Claucone and the other, psychologists and anthropologists here at Harvard. He got interested in projective tests, and he did his dissertation comparing the projective test results among four different Native American tribes, and he worked with people who were already collecting that data, and he also collected his own. And so in that way, and he did this research that was, it was kind of like, it was extremely well received because he was arguing against the grain of culture and personality studies, which had commonly assumed that people's personalities almost always mimicked or were determined by their cultural surroundings. And he showed that it wasn't a determinative relationship. And so it was actually quite progressive that, you know, people might not always, you know, it was kind of arguing against cultural stereotypes. And he was an influential kind of member of the second generation of culture and personality, which was much more subtle. But what he also noticed and was friends with many people who were doing similar collections of dreams and what they called subjective materials. And so in a way he volunteered to become the custodian of all this data. And so this was a side project really to what, initially it was a side project where he cared and others didn't care. And he noticed that other people, once they had finished their interpretation and published from their hard-won data sets, they would throw them in a corner of the office and forget about them. And perhaps when they retired or they'd be thrown away, there was no one there to curate or take care of these data sets, which in many cases had been collected over years at great effort. So so it was basically his idea to build a clearinghouse and to build a permanent structure, but in which all this data could be condensed, stored, and made available ideally, at your fingertips to future and current researchers. So he had a vision that was both about targeting a certain kind of content that hadn't really been fully preserved or taken care of, which was subjective materials, and also experimenting with format or technology of data storage. Mm-hmm. So Kaplan, I call a data, maybe a pioneer of data. And mm-hmm. he's really, I mean, he's not much remembered, I don't think. But others who have read the book have commented on how it's astounding because he's this kind of figure who was friends with so many powerful... He was there at the center of this very powerful movement of social science and behavioral science during its heyday, and yet he has kind of disappeared from view. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of reviving his effort as well, which in a sense was quite, ecumenical. It wasn't about building his own reputation. In fact, one of the reasons the Database of Dreams failed to thrive, you could argue, is that Kaplan lacked a sufficient self-promotional impulse. And he was, you know, he worked assiduously at it, but it, you know, a number of factors intervened.
Right, right. Or even a, you know, primary argument for like the validity and use of that. Because, I mean, obviously like a gratuitous example maybe, but it just makes me think of the push to sequence the entire human genome, right? Mm-hmm. And this sort of evangelical like fervor mm-hmm. possessed by James Watson. Say, we need all of it, even if it doesn't turn out to be useful, because we have to, even if, you know, we already know in advance that 98% of it or so isn't useful. We don't know where the 2% is, right? Yeah. So it's this, you know, it's this argument that's constructed on the basis of applications to human health. But projects like this seem to be, yeah, very much at the interstices of social science research, which is figuring out its many, like, multiple disciplinary identities.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point of contrast and also resonance, because Kaplan did partake in what I call the fantasy of total information, that it was necessary to have all the information before you knew what you wanted to do with it. And maybe undoubtedly future generations would be able to do other things with it, or perhaps reanalysis. Mm-hmm. So he really did think it was worthwhile, and the larger vision. So he gathered around himself many of the most eminent figures who were quite interested in issues around data collection, including people ultimately from the world of microcards and micropublication, which is an analog technique, which was really the premier technique of the time. But he also gathered around himself people like Clyde Clocone and Pete Halliwell from Pennsylvania, and Roger Barker, sort of pioneers in empirical and creative data collection across the different social sciences. And he thought they would do a sort of pilot project, which was what I call Database of Dreams applies both to that pilot project, which was the use of testing of native populations, basically, or non-literate. They call them non-literate. But also they had in mind a larger database, which would contain all sociological knowledge. And they imagined it would contain the records of brainwashed POWs, and it would contain the notes from primate stations, and it would contain the life histories of junkies, and it would contain all the dreams of Harvard undergraduates. It was almost like a modernist poem, actually. Think of it. But anyway, they didn't think of it that way. But they they did think that ultimately, if they got a sort of procedure in place, they could scoop up all the existing uncared for data in the social sciences. And in fact, Kaplan was sent by the National Science Foundation and the National Research Council to survey all social science data in the U.S. For a couple of years and just see what there was among major figures. So that's a really interesting record.
Actually, I wanted to explore a bit more this push toward microphotography and micropublication. And I guess I have like two questions. One, you know, what is it about, and where does it fall short? Because it seems it's fascinating to think at it is very pre-digital, it's very analog, it's
right.
You know, this sort of fantasy of more and more efficient storage, but then of course the problems of access. And then also I'm interested in, you know, from your actual research, are you able to really engage with these materials, the microcards? Like, are there any readers that are still accessible?
Well, there actually is one right there, which you can't see if you're listening, but my husband happened to find it walking down Divinity Avenue on campus here at Harvard.
Wow.
On a trash heap. So that's kind of an index. One of the original Redux machines. And many people mistake the microcard for microfiche, which succeeded it. The microcard was the great hope for standardization of micropublishing in the 40s and 50s. And so, and many people have terrible memories of the microfiche and the microfiche reader. Mm-hmm. So I've never seen anyone fondly remember them, but the microcard was actually a very pleasing, opaque, standardized, you know, set of cards on which you could shrink, pages of data or whatever materials you had, so that each 8.5 by 11 inch page was about the size of a fingernail. But actually, the capacity existed to shrink, you know, something like the entire Encyclopedia Britannica onto a pinpoint. I mean, they were actually, the difficulty was finding machines capable of bringing it back up, magnifying it sufficiently for use. So actually, use became a limiting factor with these cards. And there was also a portable reader, which was said to be a, you know, you could carry it to the lab, or you could take it out on the road or read. So you could ultimately read these cards while walking down the hallway, was kind of the fantasy. But in fact, the portable reader didn't deliver very high quality images. But just the fact that it was, they said it was a little larger than a king-size packet of cigarettes. Mm-hmm. You know, that this was kind of the high-tech vision of what these technologies could do. And people recognize, like Vannevar Bush, the envisioner of Memex, mm-hmm. was also experimented widely with microphotography, which he thought was the leading hope, starting in the 30s for storage, data storage. And so he tried to, you know, one of the limiting factors was searchability. So he tried to develop ways to search these microcards like the Rapid Selector. Mm-hmm. But then none of them quite worked. So actually, although Kaplan and his team ended up selecting the microcard as their vehicle, it was itself not... It was doomed in several ways. And so this is kind of a story of a failure, of an interesting failure, I think, and the kind of confluence of several factors.
Mm-hmm.
One of which was, of course, the dawn of the digital age.
But
it would be actually several decades before digital dual storage processing could even do, and databases were capable of storing the data in the way that Kaplan's team would have wanted. So actually, it wasn't that it was just around the corner. It was quite a ways away.
Mm-hmm. I think this offers a good point of departure to talk about how this work sort of intervenes in discussions about big data, right? Mm-hmm. So there are many ways, I guess, to characterize this, sort of as you just brought up, like the transition to the digital allows more like searchability. There's a lot more flattening, mm-hmm. One might say. And then the other, the other key difference, I guess, as I would see it, or sorry, rather the key resonance I would see mm-hmm. with this project is the idea of kind of latent and not active, passive mm-hmm. data accumulation and collection, mm-hmm. right? So outside of these sort of framed psychological experiments, the sort of, you know, collection of life information, and you also frame this well in the chapter on life histories, these things that would not normally be deemed valuable as such, or made kind of fungible in regimes of value generation in science, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you can do something with them.
Right.
And so that's one of the interesting things here, is that they're trying to document and preserve these social science research studies into perpetuity, and then sort of in inaugurating that drive to just collect sort of basic life histories and accumulate more and more information, it's less about framing it in a particular kind of like argumentative or experimental paradigm, but, you know, actually just collecting what's there.
Right. I think that's well put. And that's what I became interested in. I mean, in many ways, I try to call this a prehistory of big data, but it's obviously not very big in terms of big data. And it's also, you know, very different from the unstructured quality of big data. And you could draw many points of that in which it doesn't really match up, but I think it does. This project draws attention to some neglected aspects of big data that are extremely important and arguably at the core of what we're seeing that's quite new, which is that, you know, big data really is unique for vacuuming up the most intimate and seemingly banal parts of our lives, like click streams and just in an intensive way, the experiential data of, for example, driving your car, gets hoovered up and can be, for purposes as yet unknown, or perhaps, can later be used retrospectively or in all sorts of ways. But it's really, the point is to have the data and seek hypotheses later. And in that, and maybe in those two senses, both the quality of the data and its, the idea of collecting before you quite know what you, for future, for a projected future, is what you see very strongly in this project. And I think it's quite useful for as a reminder that not everything arrives with the digital. Like, we like to think that that was the, you know, that was the determinative transition. And I think it leads to a kind of technological determinism or digital determinism maybe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of these features were already in place. Several of them I name in the book, like the fantasy of total information, the pathos of the perishable format, and also just this desire to capture the ever more secret, and sometimes even the ever more just the everyday in a sort of fungible form, mm-hmm. Was very strongly felt. So why was it interesting to know, you know, how many cigarettes, an Ifalukan Islander smoked? And why did you want to know his highly, you know, It's not even a terribly interesting dream that he had in 1947 when, you know, when somebody asked him that question. But so all these things were kind of gathered up and made available, and their attempt was to preserve them. Mm-hmm. What was the other part I was going to talk about? There's the personal part, and also, yeah, the gathering without knowing. And that's kind of a, you know, that's really what proponents of big data argue is, you know, that it makes possible this fourth paradigm, to borrow from Jim Gray, that, you know, even a friend of mine who did his research, Hallam Stevens, was telling this anecdote the other day about the people at the Broad Institute he had worked with, and this real faith that the data can speak for itself if you have enough. And if you're not getting it to speak for itself, that means you don't have enough yet. Mm-hmm. And so it's just in terms of, you know, there's some kind of shift that makes possible the discarding both of experimental paradigms and even of hypotheses. And so this potentially the scientific methods being rewritten, all these claims are made. And you can see a little bit, I don't think Kaplan at all would have gone that far, but he was interested in, and many of his friends were interested in just the significance of data lay in its accumulation. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then what about this vision? And this is I think the hard question, I think for current proponents of big data, what's the vision of what one can show with that? We were talking before about the ability to plot different dreams along certain axes, and then uh-huh. with certain, you know, I feel like a lot of the dominant forms of sort of big data presentation are like clustering in network right. analyses and things like that. Uh-huh. And so I'm also, I'm wondering, how do these imaginaries of sort of proof and things that are worthy to investigate begin to change with this? Because with social scientific data, it's even harder to think about that, because a lot of it is bound up in hermeneutics and textual interpretation rather than things that are, like, you know, easily, like, graphical.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a kind of fantasy of stepping back social scientific findings from being embedded in hermeneutics and because those can be so tricky. And so data offers pattern, you know, through pattern recognition, a kind of a seemingly seamless approach. But what was I going to, there was some, I forget what I was going to say. There's some interesting thing we were just talking about.
Sort of the proof, what is created from data.
Oh, right. I had interviewed this entrepreneur, is a data entrepreneur or a dream collector, current day, named Hunter Lee Soik, who moves around the world. He doesn't necessarily live anywhere, although I guess he's currently in Dubai, and he's building an app called to collect dreams, which is, I forget the name of it, but anyway, he says it's basically, he wants to install this on everyone's phone, and in one sense it's a glorified alarm clock. It wakes you up slowly in such a way that you could remember your dream, and it also affords you the chance to record or type your dream and then upload it into a massive It's called Shadow. And their motto is Remember Your Dream, because their idea is that so much data is lost every night when we wake up and carelessly discard or fail to remember or fail to record or fail to share our dreams. So he's offering this kind of method by which this will become automatic, and he wants to know whether teenagers in Sao Paulo dream the same dream as Nigerians in a certain, you know, area, and he wants to be able to plot, like, when do certain themes arise and how do dreams patterns, can you locate patterns of content or preoccupations or emotions across the globe. So in many ways he embodies this kind of big data hope, just that first you need to put the mechanism in place for gathering all this up, and also encourage a sharing, a kind of ideology of sharing, and also, of course, of forsaking one's privacy. And this does relate to anthropologists kind of being constantly interested in whatever secret remains unsaid is, you know, irresistible to kind of penetrate and constantly penetrate. So I think there's some interesting parallel there. But so it was and it was interesting to talk to him about this project as well, which he says is still, it's still in beta phase, but he thinks it's going to be very big. Yeah. And so that also, you know, it also kind of embodies, yeah, this future mindedness, I guess you could say, the sense that you don't yet know, but it's kind of urgent to, yeah, to also not to let anything go to waste. And so there's a concern for all that, all that's neglected. So can you make an entire databases of the otherwise or previously neglected? Or I was very interested in that theme, which is kind of why I call the, I think of the book as thrift store history, is that it's kind of, it's both about people who are interested in neglected data and wanted to care for it, but also the project itself became itself a, you know, ephemeral. It was difficult to find. Often when I went to the Library of Congress, where there was a full set of microcards, the librarian there said no one had ever asked for it before, and they, and then the, you know, the clerk couldn't actually find it after much rummaging, but he finally dredged it up. But it, and then at other places it's either disappeared or the machine was just thrown away or was unable to read it. And can I tell a little anecdote about about the dreams?
Yes, that sounds great.
Yeah, I went to a talk when I first got to Harvard as a postdoc, and there was a emeritus professor giving a talk about the relationship between psychiatry and anthropology. And after his talk, I told him about my research, and he said, "Oh, I have your dreams in a box, and I've been saving them all these years. I'd be happy to give them." Beatrice Whiting gave me her copy of, I think it was Dorothy Eggen's Dreams, and he said, "Yeah, just, you know, I'll donate them to you." And then he went home to try to find them, and he wrote me sadly in an email to say that they had been apparently thrown away, and that this, you know, this highlighted to me the kind of what I think of as like the pathos of format. It's that you think that the dreams are going to be the fragile part, but it's actually the data itself and the storage format that proved to be unstable, unreliable. And I found this over and over again. I think that, again, another is another parable for our time, because who hasn't lost their entire, you know, photo archive by just the press of a button, or the idea that the cloud somehow provides ultimate stability when... So anyway, I was giving then another chapter unfolded when I gave a talk to some deans and provosts the other week, and I was mentioning this, the fate of Bob's, of this collection of dreams, and someone in the audience said, "Oh, I know Bob," and she said, she ran across that very box a few years ago, and it was labeled in an obscure library, and she said it was labeled Bob's Box of Dreams, Do Not Discard, and she said they may still have survived, and so she sent several people looking for them, and it turns out they actually had been thrown away. So this was another way in which the story, it keeps having these kind of coming, it's sort of these materials come into being and then seem to disperse their own status, ontological or at whatever level is constantly changing.
That's kind of a very poetic and tragic thing too, right? Bob's box of dreams, do not discard. You know, just thinking about being like potential valence of like, even when you were just saying, oh, I have your dreams. It's just, there's so much like personal meaning and subjective qualities bound up in all of this. That it is really tragic, right? You think about losing, like say the results of a bunch of like gel electrophoreses and, you know, who cares about things you run through a gel, but things that are both like data and also like have value in the kinds of, you know, thrift store and heirloom sorts of ways that people do hoard and keep things, it makes it like all the more tragic.
It does. It reminds me too of this, I guess the emotion that I was trying to capture in the book through telling these stories and through looking through, just kind of recovering this, in a way resurrecting this dispersed and despised, or not despised, but really this project that didn't come to the fruition they hoped for.
Yeah.
But I was, captured in this little anecdote Joan Didion tells about keeping all of her daughter, when she was a toddler, used to say clever or funny things when she was misusing language, and she and her husband would write these down, put each on a piece of paper, and then put them in a little box that was put on her husband's desk, and she could remember exactly where that was, but at some point the box had been thrown away. And now her husband was dead and her daughter had died too. And the box was gone. And it was like this sort of embodiment of all of that, passing. And, you know, you could say in the digital era, we all deal daily with that kind of ephemerality and needing to choose what to keep.
Yeah. So speaking about projects and, you know, things wrapping up and opening up again. One of the things we also like to do when we're wrapping up these podcasts is to talk about your new work, which you presented on a little bit more today. But I was wondering if you could kind of describe for listeners what your next pursuit is.
Ah, yes. Well, I'm kind of in a way circling back to an earlier interest, but it's a history. It's called The Long Shadow of Brainwashing, a History of Course of Interrogation. And so, and it's another Cold War project, this one with, I guess, significantly darker valence, but it's really about the context in which coercive interrogation techniques were codified and the behavioral science research that led to that. So in order to do that, I need to evoke the kind of great crisis of brainwashing that arose around the Korean War, which is, most people are probably most familiar with the Manchurian Candidate for kind of describing that, the fear that American soldiers were susceptible to programming, and basically that subjectivity itself was destabilized. And particularly there was a fear that Americans were the worst, that they had some kind of weakness. And so there a whole program in both training soldiers to resist torture, basically, in a systematic way, or inoculate. It was the model or metaphor used was to inoculate them against torture, but in order to do that, you had to actually torture them. So they set up camps called survival training camps in which to do that. And what's interesting to me is that the techniques that came out of all that research were standardized by the 1960s in Kubark Manual and other places. And that those were maintained almost in perfect order until the War on Terror, when they were revived, and the SEER, the survival training specialists, were themselves brought in to teach, you know, this coercive interrogation of resistant sources. And the whole project was renamed Enhanced Interrogation. What interests me also is the way the subject or the soldier is seen is quite different, although the techniques are constant. It's no longer seen as a matter of brainwashing, but actually a matter of pure information extraction. Mm-hmm. So that's the story I'm trying to tell.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. We hope to hear more about that in the next couple of years. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for speaking with us today. And thank you all out there for listening. This has been New Books in Medicine. Thanks. Bye.